Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We begin today at the beginning of a chapter. Chapter 4, Prodigal Daughters. My blue-eyed brother was born into a family of green-eyed sisters. He lived and moved among us with the anointed brow of an only son. And perhaps that's why my sisters beat him so ferociously when Mom and Dad left us alone on Saturdays for polka night or work in town. I don't count myself among the combatants because I was the youngest girl, only 6, and because of the vantage point from which I've carried the memory these 40 years, watching the scene from the living room doorway. It's dark. The lamps have been extinguished. The silent light of the TV screen casts a blue glow onto the hardwood floor. I see my 3 sisters in silhouette, circling my brother with their clenched fists raised. My brother cowers between them, covering his head with his arms. But why did they beat him? Because he was different? Because he was too cute and wore short pants? I don't recall any bloody noses or broken bones, not even a telltale scratch on our mother's immaculately polished wood floors. The blows must have been benign, and the skirmishes short, because our brother never fought back. He was gentle and sweet-natured, forgiving as Jesus under their fists. It was impossible not to love him. Nicholas, our boy king, our tiny emperor. His were the slender shoulders our farm rested on. 3 generations of land ownership hung in the balance. When he came of age in the early 1970s, my brother moved to town and rented a small house with another farm boy. Dirty dishes gathered in the kitchen sink, crumpled up beer cans collected in the garbage. He grew his hair long, raced stock cars, played the electric guitar, enlisted in the National Guard. For a time, he joined a custom combining crew and traveled around the country, harvesting the fields of strangers. My father was left at home, working his wheat fields alone. Later, my brother worked at a body shop. Then he bought a gas station. Eventually, he succumbed to my father's appeals for his return. Exhausted, perhaps, from a life lived against the grain of father's disapproval. Wasn't our brother's fate sealed from the moment of his birth? Instinctively, we girls always knew this, and I suppose in the end, that's why my sisters beat him. The year that I was forming in the womb, 1956, big things were happening in the outside world. Alfred Kinsey died, his groundbreaking work already completed. Allen Ginsberg published Howl. The first neutrino was produced at Los Alamos. In Russia, my grandparents' country of origin, Stalin was dead, and Khrushchev was denouncing him at the 20th Communist Party conference. It's sobering to think of how in progress the world is before we enter it. We arrive in medias res, like a latecomer, to a potluck, a sad bowl of potato salad in hand after everyone has filled up on baked beans and bratwurst. Arriving so after the fact, I became the mascot in family photographs, the one with the funny hat or the pigtails askew, the one with the turned-up nose caught crossing her eyes. In the choo-choo train photos my mother staged each year in front of the Christmas tree, I was always the clumsy caboose, while my siblings lined up in perfect ranks and smiled on cue, their 4 neat heads a uniformly descending staircase, I clung to my sister Jane's pant leg, a shortcake come-along, always falling down or walking out of the frame at the last moment. It seems even from the beginning I was stepping out of line. By some strange miracle, my father took a shine to me. In my early photos, I can see the tenderness in his hands as he holds me up for my baptism picture, the delight in his eyes in the snapshot of my first step. Maybe he just liked babies. Maybe he sensed I would be his last. Or maybe because my arrival coincided with my father's inheritance, the acres of rocky soil and mountains of residual debt attached to our family farm. Perhaps these two events became entwined in his imagination. I became something by which he could measure his progress. As I grew stronger, so did his grip on the albatross. As I prospered, so did the farm. What causes love? How do we ever deserve it? My father's favor, although never spoken, was always palpable. If we were kittens and our litter was threatened, I sensed my mother would be forced by biological imperative to save my oldest sister with her silken ponytail and my brother with his Y chromosome. I always knew my father would come for me. There is a gravel road about a quarter mile long leading out of my parents' farm that leads to another gravel road about a half mile long that eventually meets up with Highway 3. When I was a kid, I sat for hours in my brother's bedroom facing the highway, and I kept a running tally of how many cars and trucks passed our farm, their color, make, model, and whether the vehicle was traveling north or south. I yearned for movement back then, for escape. I spent a lot of time walking, restless, aimless pacing down the gravel road along the section lines, always kicking stones, walking with my head down, searching for some evidence that something had happened on this barren strip of land. I drew maps with large X's on them, marking the spot where surely treasure would be found. I looked for chipped arrowheads, a stone carving, an agate, an unusual rock formation. Anything to prove that someone or something, a nomadic tribe or an ancient glacier, had passed through before me, thereby proving it was possible to escape. My three older sisters made their rapid getaways after they graduated from high school, the two oldest to college, the third to marriage and children in town. One by one, their belongings were packed into cars that disappeared down the gravel road. Their old bedrooms became my pick of bedrooms. Pretty soon, I had the top floor of the house to myself, and I was left alone with my parents on that farm with so many chickens to feed, so many cows to milk, and so much land to work. From sunup to sundown, my parents ran frantically from place to place, trying to perform all the chores that kept the farm afloat. By then, they had sold their share of the bar, and the farm was our sole means of support. Since I was a teenager, and none of this had been my idea, I determined to make myself as useless as possible. The most my father could do was assign me small jobs from season to season. One of my early chores on the farm was running the De Laval cream separator, a machine that worked its transforming magic in a cozy closet off the milk room. In this sanctum sanctorum, ordinary milk was poured into a large stainless steel bowl on the top of the whirring, spinning separator. By some alchemy, the liquid filtered through the layers of the machine. After a great deal of noise and centrifugal gyration, the separator brought forth cream that flowed like gold from one of the spigots below. From the second spigot appeared the now skimmed milk, which was quickly mixed back into the pot-bellied bulk cooler. Every few days, a driver arrived in our yard with a refrigerated tanker truck capable of siphoning from the cooler the many gallons of milk we extracted from our cows. This was taken to Wishick Cheese, a factory in town, about 25 miles southeast of Napoleon, where it was turned into curd, we were told, then shipped off to Wisconsin, where it was worked into blocks and aged. When it reappeared in our grocery store as Wisconsin cheese, only we were the wiser. But the cream had choicer destinations. It was collected in pint and quart jars, each marked with the names of people in town who had ordered fresh farm cream. Mother hand-delivered the jars the next day. Of all the chores I had to do on the farm, I liked running the separator the best. The milk room was warmer than the rest of the barn, and my primary responsibility was to keep the cats away from the cream. I could take a book and read as the noisy machine churned and shook the life from the milk. Around me, things were filled and emptied, cream poured from spouts, jars were whisked away, and I was left to read my book, hunched over in the dim light. At my feet, tabbies and tomcats, tuxedos and calicos, milled and meowed. They craned their necks and howled with tortured voices. They tried to scale my pant legs, their claws out, just to get a quick paw, a stretched tongue, anything into that golden stream. I would shoo and bat them away, absorbed in thought, clutching my book and reading all the while about all the strange places and marvelous people in the outside world. I grew up in an almost bookless house, aside from the Betty Crocker cookbook and the gold-embossed row of World Book encyclopedias, which were only good for filling out the details in school reports. Great mysteries lurked out there in the world, I suspected, at which the World Book could only hint. I read voraciously as a child, everything from Dr. Seuss to Nancy Drew. In the Catholic school I attended, the only books in the library, it seemed, were The Lives of the Saints and the Baltimore Catechism. The bookmobile saved me. On Fridays, when the green and tan truck with the word bookmobile painted across its length in bold letters pulled up to St. Philip Neri, we filed in threes from our classroom to the truck parked at the curb. I grabbed the safety bar and climbed the few steps, taking in the smell of glue and old paper. I walked down the narrow aisle, running my amazed fingers along the leather spines. I imagined the gray-haired librarian who drove the bookmobile to be a secret hellraiser, a madwoman for literature, taking wild turns and careening around corners, the red velvet safety cords straining to hold the books in the shelves. All this fuss just to bring us heretical texts from the outside world. I loaded myself down, negotiating the three descending steps with a stack of books taller than my eye level. Friday nights after the school bus dropped us off at home, I crawled into bed and read. I'd fall asleep with the smell of clean sheets and the comforting weight of books around me. For all the books I read, it seems strange to admit now that I recall very few of their plots or details until I discovered the work of Carlos Castaneda as a teenager. Who in my small town could have recommended to me these books on Native American mysticism and psychotropic drugs? I recall going to the Kirkwood Mall in Bismarck on one of our semi-annual shopping trips and asking the person behind the bookstore counter for anything by Carlos Castaneda. I felt nervous, as if I were requesting pornography, but he showed me to the shelf with The Teachings of Don Juan, The Yaqui Way of Knowledge, a book that chronicles Castaneda's apprenticeship with Don Juan Matus, an expert in medicinal plants and herbs, a Yaqui shaman and sorcerer, knowledgeable in matters of personal power and all unseen matters. In the next few years, I would seek out more of his books. Journey to Ixtlan, A Separate Reality, Tales of Power. When I think of myself as a teenager reading Carlos Castaneda in my upstairs bedroom, I wonder what I could possibly have understood of the world, seen or unseen. Yet, when I look back at the actual copies of these books, I find that my underlinings and check marks were astute, that I recognized important passages when I read them. Taking death as an advisor, stopping the world, finding your power spot, losing your personal history. I remember studying these lessons, willing myself to master them in my own life. It is best to erase all personal history, Don Juan advised, because that will make you free from the encumbering thoughts of other people. Don Juan explained that you strengthen the hold of your personal history by telling your parents, your relatives, and your friends everything you do, which locks you into a personal history that is binding. Instead, you must learn fluidity and mutability. Little by little, Don Juan advised Castaneda on how to escape the limiting hold of personal history. You must create a fog around yourself. You must erase everything around you until nothing can be taken for granted. At 13, I remember how I pored over these passages late into the night, with only the deep country darkness outside and the sound of crickets, fervently vowing to someday erase myself into the larger world. Inspired by some stupid logic, I broke open a thermometer, freeing the mercury from its glass tube. No more would it be forced to serve, rising and falling encased in glass under our sick tongues. I kept the silver dollop of mercury in a saucer on my dressing table. I must be as cunning as Quicksilver, I thought. At times, when I wasn't reading Castaneda, I would roll the mercury around in my palm, contemplating elusiveness. I must learn to shapeshift, I told myself, not realizing I could have been poisoning myself. Not that I would have believed it. If a snake had bitten me, I would have thought my will was powerful enough to survive its deadly venom. I'd sit in my upstairs bedroom and jab at the drop of mercury, trying to pick it up, admiring the way it split and rolled into dozens of little pieces, evading my silver fingertips. If you're a young person growing up in the middle of nowhere, as I was, and you're not sure why the lottery of birth has landed you in this miserable locale, you begin to puzzle it out. Surely you were switched at birth, and your real parents will soon be around to pick you up. Or perhaps you were flung through space in a small pod, ejected from some dying planet in a supreme act of sacrifice by your loving parents. After all, when Superman hurtled to Earth, didn't he end up in the Midwest? In the meantime, as your powers develop, cultivate incompetence. Perform chores so slowly that people will rush ahead of you to do them, or so badly that no one will ask you to do them in the first place. Incinerate the oats and feed the milk cows the garbage. Leave gates open, let out the prize bowl. Spill whole buckets of cream and drive the new pickup too fast over rutted land. That way, you might enjoy a nice life in the country. Growing up on a farm, you see and do things you later wish you hadn't. I have castrated, for example, or rather, I have sat on top of a high, narrow corral, pressed tight the heaving flank of a bull calf with all the strength my legs could muster, looped and yanked his thick tail high in the air and to the side so that my father could come in and castrate. I've seen the long-handled pincers at work, seen the Rocky Mountain oysters roll in the dirt like two dislodged eyeballs, glossy as pearl onions. I've known people who fry up these delicacies, saute them in butter, and eat them like tender scallops. I've also known people who eat those turkey gizzards that float in pickling juices in 5-gallon jars on the counters of backwater bars, although I have not been one of those people. If you stay in the Midwest long enough and you go to the right places, you'll encounter all kinds of stuff. I've seen manure, for example, in an amazing variety of colors and consistencies. I have sprayed it with a hose, swept it into gutters, scraped it, buried it, burned it, and shoveled it. I've been up to my bootstraps in it, threatening to suck me down as I tried to step through it, spreading straw with a pitchfork so that the cows could lie one more day in it. I've seen it in pastures, huge cow pies sprouting mushrooms, amazing droppage buzzing with flies, full of grass, seeds, and maggots, or dried flat as a frisbee along the trail. There's a certain shade of it, an orangish, mustardy yellow with an almost fluorescent glow called scours, which is a signal that you probably have a very sick calf on your hands. Clothing designers have embraced this color, reproducing it lately by some unnatural combination of dyes, and when I see it in stores in the shapes of fashionable blouses, sweaters, and pants, I can't help but think of my father standing in the calf shed, pointing to the troubling pile, and then scanning the pen for the calf that's on its back, the calf with the scruffy coat, the calf with the emaciated, curving ribs. In the milk barn, I have seen Holsteins go on happily eating their oats as they raise their tails and let loose with such force, shoot it like projectile vomit across the aisle of the barn, nailing another cow or some unlucky person who may be walking through the barn at that moment. To be around for cleanup after something like this has happened is to understand what chores are. Perhaps separation became my special talent, because my father put me in charge of separating the calves from the cows when it was time to wean them from their mothers. On that day, the cows were herded into the barn, their udders heavy with milk. As usual, they filed in and put their necks through the stanchions lining the barn. The slats were closed around their necks to hold them in place during milking. But as they entered the barn, their calves were called away and taken by me to a separate pen I had prepared for them with fresh straw in another part of the barn. At first, the cows don't realize what's happening. They move through the enclosures and gates in their docile way. They eat the oats put in place for them inside the stanchion. But once outside the barn, after milking, they begin to look around, to sniff, as if trying to recall something they've forgotten. They turn their long necks. They swish their tails. Nothing. Then they begin to call out, low mooing until the calves answer. The cows moo and moo in the direction of the calves' voices, and the calves bleat back. This goes on for hours. The crying becomes unbearable. The calves look so small in their holding pen. They stick their heads through the fence, their bodies shaking as they wail. They push their hungry voices toward their mother's frantic calling. Where are you? Where are you? Here I am. Here I am. The separation of an offspring from a parent. It's the most unnatural event. You feel cruel when you're the one enforcing it. On those days, I will myself not to think about it. I only know that it's my job to feed them. I step into the holding pen with buckets of the warm milk I've mixed from powder. Our farm depends upon the real milk the mothers produce. I must convince the calves to accept the substitute. One by one, I take the bawling face of a calf into my hands and coax it toward the bucket of powdered milk. I dip my fingers in the milky liquid in the bucket, which rests hard-edged and shiny silver between my legs. I slip my wet fingers into the mouth of the crying calf. Eventually, the tongue begins to suck, from exhaustion and hunger and instinct. The soft sandpaper tongue, the little pricks of new teeth on my fingertips, the slurping as they finally dip their snouts into the bucket of milk. As they drink, the calves cry and hiccup. I stroke the curls on their soft foreheads. One by one, they stop crying as they are fed. One by one, they lie down in their new straw beds, stretching their long, downy necks, and sleep. They quiet this way, one after the other, until all is silent in the calf shed. But the crying in the mother's holding pen doesn't stop. It goes on through the night and into the next day, sometimes for hours, sometimes for days. Chores. Even the word registers a feeling for the task at hand. I've got to go home and do chores. Never singular, always plural. A job that interrupts some fun you're having, then grows and grows and grows like polyps in an intestine. One syllable quickly spat out or yelled up creaky stairs. The word chores describes a job so unsavory that to spend the energy using two syllables means you'd probably never get around to doing it. It's best to turn away from chores. Pretend you didn't hear the call. Hope someone else will do them. Better to turn back to the softness and warmth of your own bed, back to the brush of cotton and the sweet downy smell of sheets, than to skitter across cold wood floors in the dark, pull on old clothes and worn smelly shoes, and go out into the drafty, shit-smeared places where chores are done. I have been pulled from my bed in my white nightgown after I've disregarded my mother's first and second calls, my father's third call for chores. I've been taken down to the big backyard near the chicken coop to help with butchering the hens. My mother has already started. She is cutting necks. My grandmother kneels beside her, also cutting. Between them is a growing pile of chicken heads, wall-eyed, astonished open beaks, the stunned crop of white feathers against the pink, wavy flesh of fading combs. My oldest sister, Kate, is galloping around the yard like the cloaked angel of death, snaring chickens with a long wire leg catcher. When she traps them by the ankle, they squawk wildly, trying to catch the ground with the other leg and run away, until she lifts them in the air and hands them, wings flapping, feathers flying loose, over to the neck cutters. In this way, my sister is God today. My second oldest sister, Elizabeth, is retrieving the chickens from the headless places they have flown to. Around and around she runs, looking for the vivid sprays that will signal a chicken is nearby, blood rising in fountains on the white stucco walls of the chicken coop, blood bucking up against the trunks of cottonwoods, blood in soaked patches on the grass, the red iron smell of oxidization strewn across the dewy green lawn. And at this extremely dramatic moment in our story, I think we must leave the book for today. We are reading The Horizontal World by Deborah Marquardt, a professor of English and the coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. You are listening to this book on KHOI-FM's Community Bookshelf, which you can hear every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this time. The program is produced by Mary Richards, assistant producer Janet Kloss, program engineer Ron Latson, and chief engineer Rick Morrison. To listen to prior episodes of this book, go to the Community Bookshelf page at the KHOI website. This is Mary Richards. Thank you very much for listening.